Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Elizabeth Dewberry, whose latest novel is His Lovely Wife. Earlier novels include Sacrament of Lies, Break the Heart of Me, and Many Things Have Happened Since He Died. His Lovely Wife concerns a woman who is several years younger than her husband, kind of a trophy wife, more like, I'd like you to meet so-and-so and his lovely wife. And that's where the name derives, right?
Right. Okay, I'm married to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler, which is a phrase that I hear all the time. Please welcome Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler and his lovely wife. And sometimes, usually, they'll say Elizabeth Dewberry, but sometimes not. For me, the phrase at first, because it's always meant as a compliment, so at first I was sort of smiling and nodding and saying, yes, hello, I'm the lovely wife. And after not very many times, it began to irritate me. And I actually Googled the phrase, his lovely wife. And you'll find CEOs at company picnics, and probably about a third of the time it'll be, here's our boss, so-and-so, and his lovely wife, without a name. And it's not just wives of powerful men, it's just wives of men who are better known in any given circle than they are. And I think it happens to a whole lot of women, where you find that here's a man you love, you're not in it to be the trophy wife, and yet the way most people perceive you is nameless.
It doesn't work the other way. You don't hear, this is Elizabeth Dewberry and her lovely husband. You never get that.
No, and Bob sometimes says, I'm Elizabeth Dewberry's lovely husband, and it gets a laugh.
Okay, you finished Sacrament of Lies.
Yes.
At what point did you decide that you would write on this topic, and at what point did you realize the ultimate his lovely wife was Princess Diana?
Well, Bob and I, just because of the logistics of our careers, weren't able to live in the same city until after we were married. So we didn't start being introduced as Robert Olin Butler and his lovely wife until, or his lovely companion or whatever it would have been before we were married, until after we were married. But almost instantly, I realized this is something I want to write about. We got married in April of 1995, so it was a long time ago, but I didn't know what I wanted to say. I just knew that it was an untold story that a lot of women share. And then when Princess Diana died, that was 1997, a whole lot of writers were writing things for the New York Times and all kinds of radio stations, and I really couldn't think of anything to say. Later, I began to realize that my connection with her was that she had been the ultimate lovely wife, and that her whole identity in the public, but not in private, had been everything that people saw her as was defined by who she married. And her whole life was trying to assert, actually a real person, I'm actually myself. But at the same time, she was actually trying to figure out, who is this person I'm trying to assert? I identified with that. When I think I might have a novel to write, it's because I feel that there's a story that metaphorically tells a lot of women's stories, and I have to have the feeling that if I don't write it, nobody will.
So at what point did you realize, after Sacrament of Lies, that you were finally going to get around to doing it?
That's a difficult question, because for me, finding the narrator, finding the story, finding the voice were all very difficult. They took a really long time. I remember saying to Bob many times, I can't do this. I can't get this woman to tell her story. Because in the past, with my previous novels, I've felt something like the narrators had to tell their stories, almost like the novels were substitutions for suicide notes, that I'm telling this story to save my life. Well, what happens to women who are often introduced as lovely wives is that they learn how to be silent. And my narrator had learned how to be silent. And it was very hard for me to find her voice, for her to get me to trust her, and for anybody to tell their story truly makes them vulnerable, even if you're a fictional character. So there was no turning point, because for a very long time in the first 2 years of the writing of the novel, I didn't know if I was going to finish it. I did go to Paris to do research in August of 2001, and it was a fabulous trip, but then I came home, and then there was 9/11, and I couldn't write. So I wrote the whole novel, almost the whole novel, not knowing if I was going to finish it, which I think actually it was terrible for me. It was very painful, but I think it helped the novel, because I think it gave it a kind of tension that I hadn't had in previous novels.
There's another problem I could see in terms of your finding the voice in the narrator, is that you marry famous author. However, at the same time, you're a writer working on plays, you're working on novels. You've actually got a budding career as Elizabeth Dewberry, not as Elizabeth Butler. However, Ellen, our character in His Lovely Wife, is a little bit closer to a trophy wife, in that she is a beautiful woman who married a man who's a very famous physicist, clearly several years older than she is. She actually has a stepson who's closer, apparently closer to her age than she is, perhaps, to her husband. To get into that character means that you need to subsume that which is individualized in you to find her.
One time I gave a reading from this book, and a woman who was very plain-looking came up to me, and she said, "I really was moved by what you read, but it never occurred to me that a woman like you would know what it's like to feel invisible." And I'm like, oh my goodness, I feel invisible 6 days out of seven. I mean, no, it wasn't that hard to get into a woman who feels like what people are seeing is not who she is. And I have to say one thing, is that when I started writing this book, when I began to see where it was going to go, what the structure of it was, I said to my husband, okay, here's a woman who's married to an older man with a big prize, and, well, there are those superficial similarities, and people read like this, not everybody, but some people are going to look at the superficial similarities and think that I'm as angry as she is, and I'm as bored as she is, and that I have the same adventure in Paris that she does. And I said, you know, if that's going to hurt you, I can't do it. He was so great. He said, go for it. Use everything. Use any little thing anybody's ever said that made you matter, that made you understand what it's like to not be perceived for who you are. It's ironic that I needed my husband's support, almost even his permission, to write this book about a woman who is trying to assert her independence.
But it's beyond that. I mean, he's got to be kind of brave, because just as people are going to say, you are Ellen, people are going to say, he's the physicist, and the physicist does not come off very well. So there's a certain bravery in being willing to say what's on your mind, and at the same time not take it personally.
Yeah, exactly. And I wrote the physicist the way I did because I was really empathizing with Diana, who had this emotionally distant husband. And everybody who knows my husband knows he's Mr. Hugs. He is as open emotionally as anybody could possibly be. He tells me he loves me 20 times a day. But that's fiction, you know. Right. And I was really more interested in the dilemma of a woman who has an emotionally distant husband.
Does he have kids from an earlier marriage?
He has one son, and his son is closer to my age than I am to Bob. But I met his son when his son was 21, not when he was 5 or 6, so it's different.
But the difficulties do exist, I would guess. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, suddenly you've got this 21-year-old person in your life who you don't think of as your son, but who is your husband's son, and I certainly didn't think of myself as a stepmother, and we both just had to figure out what our relationship was, and it took us a while. I think we finally just decided that we're friends, but early on, we were trying to figure out what our familial relationship was and what our relationship to his father, my husband, was. And finally, I think we had to come to a sense that because we met as adults, it was different. But I was really shocked that because he was an adult, it was still difficult to find a relationship. I think most people from blended families can, but no one in my family had ever been divorced, and so I just wasn't ready for it.
Elizabeth Dewberry, okay, now you've got this character. You're finally finding her voice. Since you and your husband both deal with teaching writing in one capacity or another, what's the difference between voice and a narrator? I mean, what is voice?
Voice is soul, I think. I mean, there are things that reveal your soul that might be your rhythm, that might be your diction, but when you have a narrator, you know in your head who's going to tell the story. When you have the voice, you have the DNA of your character. It might come from one sentence, but suddenly after looking, searching, wandering for months, you suddenly hear it and it's come to life.
According to the publicity material, you sat there and had long conversations in your head with this character, Ellen.
Yeah. My parents were evangelical Christians, and we would talk about hearing the still small voice of God. And I would sort of in my mind when I would pray, I would imagine God saying things to me, just like, you know, do good on your test tomorrow, or just whatever I would imagine God would say, and I would think of myself in conversation with God. And I think there's a corollary between those two things. Even at the time, I didn't believe I was actually hearing God tell me what to wear the next day, but I was in that kind of totally religious environment where I would actually ask God what to wear the next day, and then whatever came to my head, I would thank God told me. And so because you learn to trust this voice in your head, it's actually very good training for writing fiction.
Okay, well, when you've got that voice, now the story. She arrives in Paris on the same day Diana arrives at the same hotel. Diana's killed the following morning, and we follow Ellen around for a handful of days thereafter. Those handful of days, did that emerge from those imaginary conversations?
Yeah, the structure of the novel. When I went to France to do the research, I also went to the Mediterranean coast because Diana spent her last week there, thinking, I don't know what's going to happen. So I went to Nice and I went to Monaco, and I was going to go to Saint-Tropez where Diana stopped off. And then I realized, no, she has no encounters with Diana while Diana's alive. So then I went back to Paris and I realized the whole thing, that Diana's death is the catalyst for what's basically an identity crisis. Then I realized that it had to be the way that we all reacted to her death, which was just sort of, it surprised us all how deeply we felt, or most of us anyway, and it didn't last for that long. Then we went on with our lives. So it had to happen in the way that it truly happened to a lot of people, except that for most people, they sort of got over it and went on with their lives. And for my character, whatever surfaced during those few days, she decided to live with it and deal with it.
Elizabeth Dewberry, you have another character in there named Princess Diana, and she has the same kinds of conversations in her head, Ellen does, with Princess Di that you had with Ellen.
Right. For me, it seemed very natural because I always have imaginary conversations.
In researching, you read 46 books on Diana, along with magazines?
I did. I read about a foot stack tall of magazines and 46 books, and they were fun. It was sort of like eating intellectual junk food, honestly. I mean, most of them are badly written, and most of them have an agenda, but somehow you come out of all of those understanding that there is this complex woman who, even given that she participated in her own autobiography, no one was able to capture. I love that kind of character. I would love to create more of that kind of character.
Well, how did you find that particular voice? At some point, did Princess Di, in the same manner, begin whispering in your ear?
You know, I kind of wished that she would. I wished I could tell a real ghost story, you know, or even a dream, but it didn't happen that way. A few things that were very helpful to me were the Andrew Morton biography that had the tapes that she had made transcribed. But also, while I was writing the book, there was a show on CBS where she was seen practicing vocal coaching with a coach, and you could see her off the cuff, and you could hear her. It's very rare that you hear her talking casually. That was a really important way of getting her voice and its rhythms into my head. But at some point, she had to become a fictional character in my mind, and I hope that I did her justice, but I also had to create someone who rang true within the novel. It wasn't a work of history.
You're listening to an interview with Elizabeth Dewberry, author of the novel His Lovely Wife. Elizabeth Dewberry, a lot of this book concerns paparazzi and the culture of celebrity, and it seems to come in through the back door. But we're living in a society which seems to treasure celebrity or fame over talent or anything else.
Yeah.
How much of those ideas do you think that you might have came into the context of the book?
It's hard for me to quantify it that way, but I do know that a lot of the times when I feel invisible as a writer, when I walk into the bookstore and it's Da Vinci Code, Da Vinci Code, Da Vinci Code, what is this all about? You know, there is definitely the feeling as a writer that it's very difficult to find an audience outside of the context of fame. I'm interested in celebrity, but I'm interested in how we use certain celebrities to project our lives, to look at our lives writ large. And I think that we, especially with Princess Diana, she served the same function that a lot of Greek gods and goddesses used to do, which is she made all the mistakes that we make in small ways, and she made them in huge ways. And we have little weddings. She had a huge wedding. We have our children. She had world famous children from before they were born. So that we get to look at her successes and her mistakes and feel validated, but also learn from them. I mean, I think that there is a certain extent to which celebrity performs an important function in society that religion used to perform. I mean, a lot of people still look at Jesus and look at their life writ large, or Muhammad and look at their life writ large and go, that's what I want to do, or in other cases, that's what I don't want to do.
Well, it's also, of course, distracting, and, you know, for any government that wants to sneak anything through,
right,
that if the front pages are lined with celebrity stories, we don't know what's really going on, and everyone is distracted.
You know, I think that's absolutely true, but I think it's possible that we're starting to turn a corner. And I think Paris Hilton is a huge example of that, because everybody's going, what did we just do, spending 2 years watching Paris Hilton? But I think even with Angelina Jolie, who was doing and is doing some legitimate good work, I think people are finally going, why did that fascinate me a year ago? I feel a cultural shift going on.
Elizabeth Dewberry, there's another area of the book that I would like to talk about here, which is the physics in the book. You have her, Ellen, married to a physicist. Why
Yes.
did you choose a physicist, and why did you suddenly get into reading about string theory?
Well, I was really fascinated by physics because this actually comes from Stephen Hawking, who says, if you're going to ask why you're here, you have to ask why we're here. And if you ask why we're here, you have to ask why the planet is here, and then you ask why the universe is here, and suddenly you're into what is the universe even made of? I don't think everybody makes that transition, but I think that it's an interesting way of asking, of relating the little questions to the big questions. And I started becoming interested in physics because I was writing a play about several people who do past life regressions, and they all come out of the past life regressions and under hypnosis believing they used to be Joan of Arc. And one of them finds a way of going, well, our atoms keep getting redistributed, and maybe in some sense we all used to be Joan of Arc. And that's actually probably true.
Is this play for Jones and a Fire Reader?
Yes. So I was interested in it way before I started this book, and I started reading about chaos theory, which is interesting, but chaos theory offers a lot of really easy metaphors that are just too easy. So I kept reading further because I thought, I know that I want to have a really intelligent narrator. I don't want this to be something that people can say, oh, Princess Diana, the idiot. And people who cared about Princess Diana often get dismissed by the literati, by the intelligentsia. It's not right, because a lot of people who cared about her were intelligent people. I wanted to honor that part of them by creating an intelligent woman, and I wanted her to, I knew that she would be trying to understand the world, the universe, her place in it, from, among other things, her husband's point of view. So I kept reading in physics until I found string theory, which suddenly resonated deeply with me and with the character. And in one sentence, and this doesn't do it justice at all, but string theory is basically the idea that at the smallest and greatest levels, all anything in the universe is vibrating energy. Just like the strings of a violin can create every sound there is, if sound were physical things, it's the same principle. And I loved that, because I thought we all can resonate to the idea that we are bundles of energy, and that's what connects us to each other, and that's what connects us to the farthest ends of the universe. I just thought it was beautiful.
How easy or hard was it writing the physicists' conversations among themselves?
I think that was the most difficult part, because for them, it's second nature. And for me, I talked with several physicists at Florida State University near where I live. I read a lot of physics books, and it never became second nature for me, like most of the other things in the book did.
You also have a character who could be his lovely physics assistant. And that means you had to do some research in the way women are treated in science.
Yeah. This was from talking to physicists. I didn't actually go about searching for that. It just suddenly came out very clearly that every time I asked the dean to help me, do you have a physicist who does chaos theory? Because, as I said at the beginning, I was interested in chaos. Do you have a physicist who works in string theory? And then we have a person at Florida State who had won a Nobel Prize. Every single time I met with these people, not only were they all men, but they never mentioned women. They mentioned their colleagues. And so I began to try to seek out women physicists, and it's difficult for women in the sciences still.
It seems that as you do your research in this book, not just in looking at Diana and looking at your own situation, the fictional situation of Ellen, women still have a long way to go.
You know, I was surprised that that's what came out of the book, too, because I'm a feminist, but I'm not a person who goes around angry about the place of women in society. I was just trying to tell this one woman story, and in the process of telling her story, yeah, a lot of things came to light that I had not been paying attention to.
It's a very angry book. It turns out that way.
It is, and I was shocked at that too. am I that angry? I'm not sure.
At what point did you realize? Were you finished with the book when you went back and went, "What the hell have I written?"
Yeah, the whole time I was writing it, I did not know what I was writing. It always felt like juggling broken eggs. It really always felt like such a fluid thing that I didn't know how it would turn out. I didn't know how it would end. I rewrote the ending many times. So, no, I really didn't know what the book was saying until I read it in galleys.
You and your husband, Robert Olin Butler, live in Tallahassee, Florida. What is the political sense that you have around there?
The two counties that we live in Jefferson County, and Florida State University is in Leon County, and those counties both went Democratic both times. And we're in North Florida that feels geographically much more like South Georgia than South Florida. So we feel like we're in, and this is not a phrase I'm making up, the other Florida. We don't feel like we belong to Florida. We don't feel like we, though, that we're embraced by the rest of the South. But there is a deep sense that I think is shared by more and more people across the country that something just went badly wrong, and that not all of it was our fault, but surely we could have done more because it was so close. Surely we could have made more of a difference. I think it's more sorrow than anger, and probably it needs to get to the point where it's anger before something is going to happen that happened in Berkeley in the 60s. It's possible that we're headed in that direction because more and more people feel disenfranchised.
Elizabeth Dewberry, you've written this book. Are you working on any plays or books?
Yeah, I read on the internet that Stephen Hawking had been to a strip club, and he goes to these with some frequency, and when he does, he calls the press, and I began to wonder what it would be like to have given a lap dance to Stephen Hawking. So I'm still wondering. I'm beginning to find out.
How about plays?
No, I'm moving away from plays, partly because I'm a very slow writer, and if it takes me 3 or 4 years to write a novel, I just don't have time to write plays too. The American theater is sadly in really bad financial shape, and theaters who really want to do new innovative work are having to do Hello, Dolly! And the Rocky Horror Show. So it's harder and harder for playwrights, and it breaks your heart to be a playwright these days. And more playwrights are moving into writing for the big screen because at least it pays money. I hope something turns that around, but for me, I've taken to writing novels more.
You've been listening to an interview with Elizabeth Dewberry, whose latest novel is His Lovely Wife. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.